Man, it's a busy day in Davos, Switzerland. How do you choose what to do?
Hello, you've reached the Davos World Economic Forum activity line. Here are the events for Wednesday, January 28th, 2009. The Economist's Group Hug Workshop begins promptly at 8 a.m. and is completely full. No latecomers will be admitted. The workshop, Charles Ponzi, Swindler or Visionary? Lessons for Today's World, the John Thane Keynote, has been canceled. No further information. Instead, former World Bank President Paul Wolfowitz will lead the seminar, How to Live Rent-Free in Your Unused Gulfstream 5. The 10 o'clock, Making Real Money, Selling Your Stuff on eBay, Bankers Can Do It Too, has been moved to the main auditorium. Losing Billions and Finding the Meaning of Life, the Warren Buffett workshop, has been canceled for lack of interest and replaced by Martha Stewart's Wallpapering with Credit Default Swaps, a new look for a new century. The Citigroup Luncheon Reception is now a cash bar event. Drink tickets can be obtained from Mr. Vikram Pandit at the Citigroup booth. The CEO Job Fair has been extended for an additional session. It will begin right after the breakout, Think Beyond Capitalism, Tips on Relocating to China. If you're looking for where Bernie Madoff put all the money, get in line. Remember, the World Economic Forum 2009 accepts only cash. We're not as dumb as you think.
Not so dumb. We're The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, January 28th, and I bet, you know what, that CEO job fair is going to
be packed. It'll be packed. Very chilly in Davos. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning, John, and good morning, everyone. Today, we talk about Davos. We also go to Baghdad for the latest on their upcoming elections and to France for the food competition unlike any other. Those stories are coming up. First, the top stories at this hour.
Today is step one for the Obama economic stimulus package. It faces a vote in the House. A solid Democratic majority basically guarantees passage, but the White House wants more, namely Republican votes. Here's GOP House Leader John Boehner.
We had a very good conversation with the president. He reiterated his desire to work with us to try to find common ground where we could.
Polite words aside, yesterday, it doesn't look like there's enough common ground to get many Republican votes in the House today. Better outlook for greater Republican support in the Senate. Obama will talk to top generals at a Pentagon visit today. The main topics will be Iraq and Afghanistan, getting out of one and going big in the other. The president wants a troop withdrawal in Iraq within 16 months.
Gaza is active, just as U.S. Special Envoy George Mitchell is in the neighborhood for meetings with the Israelis and Palestinians. Today, Israel bombed tunnels into Gaza. They say Hamas uses them to smuggle weapons. The strikes are retaliation for a roadside bombing that killed an Israeli soldier yesterday. No militant group has claimed responsibility for that blast. Former Senator George Mitchell has met with Egypt's president. He'll next meet separately with Israel's prime minister and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesman Yossi Levy says that President Obama has said much of what Israel likes to hear.
Mitchell has no plans to meet with Hamas. So John Updike died yesterday at age 76. He worried that people no longer read books. But we want to know, if you're not reading, what is it that you do to express your literacy? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Last book you read or last whatever you read. Tell us.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. The early voting has begun. Well, over in Iraq, anyway. There is a very important test this week in Iraq of that country's fledgling democracy, co-written in part by Bush administration officials. As the U.S. contemplates withdrawal of its forces from Iraq, the Iraqi government is going to have to take the reins. And that test comes on Saturday, officially, as provincial elections get underway. And they involve about 15 million Iraqis who are eligible to turn out to vote. Earlier this morning, we spoke with BBC Baghdad correspondent Andrew North and Marina Ottaway, the director of the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And when we spoke, I started by asking Andrew to give us his sense of the excitement of the impending vote, if indeed there was any.
Well, I think that's the right question, because having been back in Iraq for just over a week in the run-up to these elections, it's a very low-key campaign so far. Now, when you drive around Baghdad and other cities, I drove south to the city of Najaf yesterday, you see posters all over the place for all the many thousands of candidates that are running. But there's no real sense of election fever, partly for reasons of security. There aren't many big rallies. People are still scared of possible attacks if there's large gatherings out in the open. So generally, they're tending to hold political rallies inside where they think it'll be a bit safer. And I think the other thing, the other element to this is that a lot of people are very sceptical about whether their politicians can really deliver. They haven't been too impressed with the kinds of politicians their fledgling democracy has delivered so far.
Marina Ottaway, certainly one is tempted to conclude from what Andrew North is saying that there is a degree of skepticism on the part of Iraqis that might suggest they don't really believe in their democracy. But is there another way of looking at this, that possibly getting away from the hysteria of the early Bush years in Iraq might be a good thing for people to think of government and elections as something that's part of day-to-day life?
Well, I tend to share the skepticism about the idea that these elections are going to change anything drastically in the country. There are three issues that are involved in the election as I see it. One is the distribution of power between Shia and Sunni, and I don't think elections are going to be a major difference. Even if the Sunnis vote in large numbers, as they did not in the last election, they are still going to emerge from the election as the minority, as a minority group, not as the majority. So I think that there will still be a certain sense of grievance on the part of the Sunni community. The second issue is, and that's probably the most important, is the distribution of power among Shia organization on one side and Sunni organizations on the other. And that is where I think we may see some change, in the sense that many of the Sunni parties that are in the parliament now are not expected to do terribly well. And then there is the break on the Shia part, there is a breakdown of the coalition between the prime minister and the movement of Al-Hakim. And that is probably the most important part of the election.
Well, and what you're describing paves the way for a further consolidation on the part of Shiite parties. I'm wondering if there's any way for this provincial election to change the sort of designated status quo at the national level, which has a Kurdish president, a Shia prime minister, and some Sunni participation in the ministries. Is that going to pretty much stay the equilibrium point, the stalemate?
Well, that is going to remain until the national elections that are going to take place at the end of the year. These are just elections for the provincial councils. The only thing that might change, but this we'll have to see in the future, is the balance of power between the central government and the provincial governments. At this point, the power is all in the hands of the central government. The provincial governments have very little power. The new election law theoretically gives a little more power to the provincial councils, but we'll have to see how it plays out in practice, because it's a country with a strong tradition of centralization, and the government is not going to give up easily.
And Andrew North, let's talk about that for a moment. These are provincial elections. What sort of local control do village and city councils have, and what can they acquire in the next several years leading up to national elections?
Well, in some ways, this election is crucial in settling that, because there are some who want provincial councils and particularly regional provincial governors to have much more power. At the moment, they do have their own budget, so therefore they have quite a lot of influence over what money can be spent on in their areas. And so that's one reason why they matter. But there's a particularly important battle that is going on down in the south, which will have much longer term ramifications, because one party, Hakim, the group led by Abdulaziz Al-Hakim, which Marina was referring to there, which is the Supreme Council, which is in fact close to the US, they are now pushing forward a program to turn the southern 9 provinces, which are all majority Shia, into a new super region, and they would make Najaf, the holy city of Najaf, the capital of this super region. In other words, therefore, they would be taking much more power there to decide their own affairs.
Would that be mirrored on the Kurdish semi-autonomous region in the north, or something exactly, more like partition?
Exactly.
I see.
That's right. They are citing the Kurdish region as the example, as the model, and saying, well, if they have one, why shouldn't we do the same? And this would be good for our people down there. But it's not just that there's opposition from the Sunni side. There's opposition within the Shia parties to this idea, with some saying that this could, if it is pushed forward, lead to the breakup of Iraq. And, of course, it's particularly interesting given that the Supreme Council is, at the moment, still seen as being very close to the US, who generally they support some federalism, some push to give more power to the regions, but not if it goes to the extent of leading to the breakup of the country. So it's potentially quite a sensitive issue, and that's one reason why these elections, although in many ways they're being seen as a kind of test of where the country is and also a guide to what will happen in the elections at the end of the year, the more important elections, they could actually produce new fault lines in the country.
And Marina, the fact that there are 14,000 candidates for just 440 council seats, does that reflect how fractured the leadership is for both the Shia and Sunni communities?
I think this is fairly typical in countries that never had election before or do not have a tradition of democracy, that in the early election you have an enormous number of freelancers of would-be parties. There are something like 400 parties in Iraq at this point, but organizations and candidates that don't have any chance of ever getting elected. It seems to happen in all first or second elections in all countries, so I would not attach too much importance to that.
Well, let's track the money, if we could, in the last minute or so that we have. Marina and then Andrew, if you could respond to this. The U.S. handed over the payment of village councils in Anbar province, and there was not an explosion either of corruption or instability. So it appears that administering money at that level, the Iraqi military is fairly good at. Is there any sense that the central government or the village councils with their budgets are doing a better job of distributing money without being accused of corruption? Marina and then Andrew.
I really don't know how to answer that, in the sense that there has been much less scrutiny on the local governments and on the provincial governments than there has been at the national level. I would expect, frankly, corruption to be widespread at all levels. We just know more about what goes on at the center.
Oh, man, you're tough, Marina. Andrew?
Well, one thing I would say is it does depend on where you go. I was certainly struck yesterday when I travelled down to Najaf on how good a condition the city of Najaf is in compared to Baghdad. Infrastructure-wise, Baghdad needs a lot of work. There are some bits and pieces going on here and there, some bridges being rebuilt and this kind of thing. But Najaf is in a lot better condition. A lot more money seems to have been spent down there. And this is a place that 4 years ago, you may remember, was hit by very heavy fighting between U.S. forces and the militia of Muqtada Sadr. So I think it depends on where you go.
Well, there you go. The tough nut, as always in Iraq, is Baghdad. And we'll see more about that as these provincial elections take place on Saturday. That was Andrew North, BBC Baghdad correspondent, and Marina Ottaway, director of the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Well, those guys are readers, and that's what we're asking our listeners this morning about being readers. John Updike died of cancer at age 76, and one of his laments was that people aren't reading as much anymore. Anne writes on our website, I loved Updike's statement about writing literary fiction and that he did not go out to write it. The last book I read, Anne says, was Dawn Keepers by Jessica Anderson. It's the second book in her new series about the final prophecy, paranormal romance. It sounds like a subgenre.
And one of our listeners liked your thought. He is currently reading John Updike's In the Beauty of the Lilies and have been deeply into it, writes Jeremy.
877-8-MY-TAKE, last book you read, or my take at thetakeaway.org. Or if you're not reading books, what are you reading?
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. The prolific author John Updike has died. He was 76 years old, and his lament right up to the end of his life was that people no longer read books. So we want to hear from you. Was Updike right? Tell us the last book you read and why. And hey, if you don't read books, what do you read? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
It used to be, not so long ago, that among the most coveted invitations you could ever receive was to be invited to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. It's day one of Davos 2009, and the invitation doesn't quite have the cachet that it used to, particularly in these dire economic times, and these world leaders, many of whom have lost billions, are going to have to discuss problems that are not only personal, but global. We're joined by Andrew Ross Sorkin, who's on the line from Davos, Switzerland. He's a columnist for the New York Times. He's also chief mergers and acquisitions reporter there. Not much to write about on that beat these days. Andrew, what is the mood there in this strangest of Davos years, it seems to me?
Well, I'll tell you, it is very strange, and I'm actually on the phone to you here right from the main Congress Center here in the hallway. So if you hear a lot of background noise, that's what that's about. But, you know, what's happened here is actually quite extraordinary. Really, within the past week, there have been almost now 100 dropouts of some of the biggest name people who were supposed to be here. Of course, the focus was supposed to be on the economy, and it still is. But what's so interesting is that Wall Street, if you will, which had really taken over this conference, you know, people here used to call this sort of a capitalistic orgy, have decided not to come. They're calling it the John Thane effect, which is, if you recall, John Thane, CEO of Merrill Lynch, was ousted from Bank of America last week, in part because he was planning to come to Davos, a decision that people thought was sort of demonstrated poor taste in this belt-tightening economy. So it's a very different feeling.
Well, Andrew, of course, he's got to stay home and work on his resume a little bit there, too, probably, I would think.
Right.
You know, it seems as though the profile of being at Davos and getting an invitation to Davos has been trumped by canceling and deciding to pull out of Davos.
I think that's exactly right, and you're seeing it both from the investment banking, Wall Street, finance side of the world, which frankly has been funding this conference for years, as well as the political side. Larry Summers, who's been a regular here for years, was supposed to be here, canceled. Sheila Bair, who runs the FDIC, supposed to be here, canceled. Governor Patterson, supposed to be here, canceled. Barney Frank, supposed to be here, canceled. Tim Geithner, who's just now the Treasury Secretary, supposed to be here, canceled. The meetings with all the economic ministers still happening. All the global ministers will be here except the Americans. So there's clearly something going on and something in the water to the extent that people don't feel comfortable taking flights to Davos in an economic environment like the one we're living in.
Do you think this is just a sort of a looks and kind of a conflict of interest sort of impulse,
well, you know,
on the part of the Americans, or are they really making an anti-capitalist statement allowing Vladimir Putin to be the keynoter and to open this conference?
Well, no, and Vladimir Putin is opening the conference tonight. No, I think this is a PR problem, which is, you know, to come to Davos is an expensive trip, no matter how you slice it. And when you actually start looking at the numbers, it becomes quite expensive. You know, for one person, a corporate business person, to come here, the invitation alone is effectively $85,000. If you decide you want to come with a delegation of two or three people, you're talking about $150,000. If you want to come with more and go to certain meetings, it's $230,000. It's a very expensive proposition, and that's before you start adding in the private planes and helicopters. So there's no question that people in this environment would be taken to task for this. And, you know, other CEOs, by the way, have been taken to task for Davos before. Carly Fiorina, who was the ousted CEO of Hewlett-Packard many years back, one of the reasons cited when she was fired was sort of her focus on her public profile over the business, and people focused on her time here in Davos.
Well, then it's possible that this conference may represent something of a rise of the private sector as a source of visionary kind of, you know, where's the world go from here sentiment, since the private sector has dominated so much in the past.
Oh, absolutely. But I think in this case, as we move away from the masters of the universe, the people who are now powerful actually are the people who are here. It is Prime Minister Gordon Brown. It is Vladimir Putin, frankly. It is the political set, and that's where this is all moving.
So Valerie Jarrett from the Obama administration is the sort of low-profile U.S. participant who probably suddenly has a line following her around like, you know, a rock band.
I haven't seen her yet, but I imagine if she's here and when she arrives, you will bet she will be trailed. And there is no question that historically, actually, in years past, Condi Rice has been here. Others have been here, much higher profile. I think also there's an administration issue, which is, you know, they just had the transition. And so the idea of having people not in Washington where they need to be poses another sort of PR problem.
You know, the Davos conference has been long associated with a kind of self-congratulatory looking back at look how well we've done and the future must be bright because we've done so well. How well will Davos really tackle serious problems and an acknowledgement of past failings, do you think?
Well, you know, I've been coming to the conference for several years now, and I would actually dispute that in this respect. Last year, the tone had actually already shifted. And, you know, had you been here, most people here, to the extent they saved themselves, they sold their stock. I kid you not. If you had actually been at many of the panels and many of the dinners and meetings and different conversations, you know, I think people saw it and they saw it coming, and this is where you'd see it coming first. So I don't think it was that. It has in years past been self-congratulatory. The conversations, you know, veered off into other topics, climate change, philanthropy, all sorts of other things in the boom times. But I think now, I mean, the stars of this gathering are Nouriel Roubini, the professor at NYU, who's known as Dr. Doom, who's called this economic collapse.
And Muhammad Yunus. Microcapitalism, yep. Suddenly. Well, Andrew Ross
Absolutely.
Sorkin, thanks so much for joining us. Don't have too much fun there. You know how bad it'll look.
I will try not to. Thanks so much, John.
Andrew Ross Sorkin is on the line from Davos, Switzerland. He's a columnist for our partner, the New York Times. And now we have headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. There are some local elections happening in Iraq on Saturday, but government and military officials can vote starting today. And that's because they'll be on security duty for the weekend election. The voting determines governing councils in most of Iraq's provinces. Meanwhile, Iraq will be a major topic of conversation in a Pentagon meeting today between President Obama and military leaders. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says that they are laying out some different ways to achieve a White House goals, and the president has previously called for a swift withdrawal of American troops from Iraq and a stronger American presence in Afghanistan. The past week saw Democrats retake the White House. Today, the Republican Party takes a step towards recovery. The winter meeting of the Republican National Committee starts today, and party leaders will map out a comeback strategy and elect a leader of the party. Six candidates are competing for the party chairmanship, including incumbent chair Mike Duncan. That's looking at news for now.
Thanks very much, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. John Updike is dead at age 76. He wrote a lot of books, lots of themes, but in his public speaking, a consistent theme was a decline of reading. People no longer read books, he said. So we want to hear from you. Was Updike right?
Yes, my name is Larry Katz, calling from the Boston area. Last book I read was Invisible Monsters by Chuck Palahniuk. Great book. Enjoyed it thoroughly. Liked Chuck a lot. I think the people that are 40-plus I'm still reading. If not, why is everybody still writing?
Hey, what about 40 minus? You just burned through the Stephanie Meyer's books,
I
right?
I did. Yeah. I have to confess. Right. I loved them. The vampire teenage love story. Go. It was very entertaining.
My daughter's in the middle of them as well. And my last book was People of the Book by Geraldine Brooks. Fabulous read. Tell us the last book you read and why. Or if you don't read books, what do you read if you're under 40? Blogs, columns, or do you listen to podcasts? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Now we're going to move on to one of our favorite topics here at The Takeaway, and that has to do with food. A culinary competition is underway in France. It's not just any competition. It's often referred to as the Olympics of cooking. And as we speak right now, teams of chef extraordinaires from 24 countries are gathered at the Bocuse d'Or in Lyon. An American team has never won in the 20 years this competition has been running. Philippe Auclair, a food journalist and trained chef in London, joins us now to explain. Welcome, Philippe.
Hello.
It sounds like a big party, especially for those hundreds of people who are watching the chefs put together their elaborate meals, but it's really grueling. Explain.
Well, it is absolutely grueling. It's actually, it might be very surprising for some people, but it's not just turning up, with your hat and sitting at a cooker and doing your meal. It's actually a competition which requires months and in some cases years of preparation. I think the American candidate, Timothy Hollingworth, if I'm not mistaken, has been training for something like 3 months solid, and I mean solid, that is 40 to 50 hours a week, preparing, thinking of what he was going to do. I mean, you have to do two courses, one fish course, one meat course, and obviously the quality has got to be extraordinary, both in presentation and in taste, because a jury is composed really of some of the greatest cooks in the world, and therefore it becomes also a matter of national pride. The French obviously are riveted by this competition, which has been very good for us, I have to say, over the past few years. I mean, we've won the last two, and France has more or less dominated, together with the Scandinavians, which is a bit surprising, this competition.
Well, it sounds to me, Philippe, like the fix is in.
What do you mean?
How is it that the French keep winning the gold?
Well, you could say that, first of all, you've got to think of the people who actually take part in the competition. We are not talking about established chefs, you know, people like Heston Blumenthal or Ducasse or people like that. We're not talking about this kind of three-star restaurant chefs who are already in place, have got a following, have got fans and so forth. They are up-and-coming chefs. So, and a lot of the training still in world cuisine is actually a training that takes place in French restaurants, in many French restaurants. So, for example, Hollingsworth himself has actually trained in France, and so therefore there is a bias towards French cuisine. Of course, it is after all under the tutelage of Paul Bocuse, who is certainly the greatest living representative of French Nouvelle Cuisine. So all this explains maybe why there has been, a certain bias towards French cooks. I know that some people think there is a conspiracy at the bottom of this. I know the Spaniards are still very, very upset at what happened, I think, 4 years ago when they thought, we are going to win it. And they finished, I think, next to last because something went terribly wrong in the presentation.
So even if an American wins, it still could be French cuisine that wins.
It is French cuisine.
I see. So grilled cheese sandwiches aren't gonna win any points there.
I don't think so. That's actually one criticism which has been made of the Bocuse d'Or, that it needed maybe to open itself a little bit more to new trends in cuisine. The fact that cuisine tends to be quite global these days. If you go, and for example, to Heston Blumenthal's The Fat Duck, I mean, the best restaurant in England, and you see their menu, you will see that there are influences from all over the place within a French tradition, as far as the technique is concerned. And to be honest, the organizers, Paul Bocuse amongst themselves, would be delighted if the winner was not a Frenchman this year. And they would be even more delighted if it were an American who won.
Let's talk about the food for a second. It really is elaborate, right? These teams have to put together their meals in 5 hours and 35 minutes. I read this one yesterday. Beef tenderloin covered with oxtail pate, stuffed with truffles and foie gras, and wrapped in a pine nut crust.
Yes. So... You would say, well, yummy and maybe a little bit on the heavy side. But what you would say is that it's not just the taste of the presentation. Also, you want to find out who is the best cook. So you want to find out who has the greatest control, mastery rather, of his craft. So therefore, this means that your dish will not only have to be exquisite to the taste and beautiful to the eye, it will also have to show that you master every single aspect of food preparation, be it for in the reduction or you do for your sauces, your stocks, which actually you can do in advance. You can bring them to the competition, but also the mastery of different types of techniques of cooking, be it roasting, be it stewing, whatever. And you have to put all this, concentrate all your know-how into dishes, and which is why people spend so long experimenting, making sure they absolutely control every flick of the knife, every little drop of sauce. And so that explains why it's such a marathon. It's not just over 2 days. Mm-hmm. It's actually over a period of a year.
I want to volunteer to be a taster there. Philippe Auclair, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Philippe is a food journalist and a trained chef in London, and he was telling us about the Beaux Coup d'Or that's happening in Lyon, France. And that includes chefs from Brazil to South Korea, from all over the world. The Food Olympics, they call it. Now we're going to turn to Femi Okeh, who's got some headlines for us.
Hello there, just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. I'm sure British food will obviously sweep the board there.
Bangers.
Yeah. Bangers and mash.
Oh,
fish
yeah,
and
definitely.
Chips.
Those beans and eggs, I think so, yeah.
Cornish pasties. Anyway. Oh, I'm hungry now. Good morning, all. The House will vote today on President Obama's economic stimulus package. He spent yesterday wooing Republicans to vote for the $825 billion bill. Now, Democratic lawmakers made a very small concession yesterday. They voted to delete $200 million, and that was intended to renovate Washington's National Mall. And Republicans called the spending wasteful. Middle East envoy George Mitchell says that it's critical that a ceasefire in Gaza lasts. He's in Israel and the Palestinian territories today, and the Secretary General of the Arab League, Amr Moussa, is eager to see Mitchell get to work. And an MP3 player that contains US military files is back in government's hands. We talked about this on The Takeaway yesterday. A New Zealand man found the data after buying the player in an Oklahoma thrift store. He's been given a new MP3 player.
Still hungry, Femi?
Oh, absolutely.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. John Updike died yesterday. There's probably no greater advocate of books and reading than this author, who created so many of them and read so many of them. For someone who thought of writing and literature as so important, he was known for writing about the most ordinary of things. Here's Updike writing about his own young life.
All those years in Shillington, I'd waited to be admired, waited patiently, for there was considerable pleasure in the waiting, the lying low, the keeping, in one of my grandfather's favorite phrases, out of harm's way. Pleasure in the shyness, the malicious slyness, the burrowing in New York magazines and English mystery novels for the secret passageway out, the path of avoidance and vindication. I hid a certain determined defiance. I would not teach, I would not farm, I would not, deep down, conform. I would show them.
He became a writer. Show them he did. This chronicler of the ordinary had little use for style, and indeed, his quiet, measured voice was always unmodulated, always familiar, in fiction or nonfiction.
I'm not, I don't think, a very conscious stylist. I write at, I would say, medium speed. I don't write as much as Joyce Carol Oates, but I seem to write more than William Styron, say, or J.D. Salinger. I write about 1,000 words a day and try to make them as good as I can.
Medium speed, right. A half-century career produced more than 50 books, one per year. an output he described as modest. He wrote novels, 20 of them. There were collections of poetry, a vast array of nonfiction, including some of the most important literary criticism written in English. Updike's last published work was a review of Toni Morrison's A Mercy in the New Yorker magazine last November. Updike, a voice of the modern American writer, in fact, a biographer of that American voice he fancied himself.
That's what I imagined when I set out in this curious trade, that I would be an American writer, writing about America and trying to, in some ways, enlarge my fellow countrymen's sense of their country. Whitman celebrated America in a way that it can hardly be voiced now, 150 years later. And of course, he was, until the end of his life, rather neglected. So his attempt to address America and tell them how wonderful they were, how wonderful American people are, fell on deaf ears until the end.
Updike, of course, never had such problems. One thing he worried about in his own work was being categorized. Being John Updike was category enough for him. He celebrated all writers and readers alike. His greatest concern, perhaps, that there would be readers in the future. His lament right up to the end.
People don't read books the way they used to. There is no Steinbeck or Hemingway who captures the public imagination as those men in their works did.
Perhaps Updike's lament was well-founded. Writing diminished? Reading declining? Was he right? Here's what some of you think.
I don't believe that people read, and I think that's because they're distracted by other things like blogs and news that they can get on the internet and just fast information.
Hello, this is Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. I just finished reading The Power Broker, about the life and career of Robert Moses. And then right after that, I read Can't Stop, Won't Stop, which is the story of the hip-hop generation, and they go perfectly together.
Updike would be smiling. We're asking you, if you don't read books, what do you read, or what's the last book you read? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, January 28th, and Femi Oke has just joined us with some headlines.
And the time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. Today, the new commander-in-chief drops in on other commanders. President Obama meets with top generals at the Pentagon this afternoon. No surprise that most of the discussion will be about Iraq and Afghanistan. The president wants a speedy withdrawal from Iraq and a bigger American force in Afghanistan, and the generals will tell him what they think can be done and when. Iraq's local elections begin today. Certain government and military officials can vote now, and they're allowed to cast early ballots because they'll be on security duty when the election happens on Saturday. The voting determines governing councils in most of Iraq's provinces. This week, the Republican Party attempts a resurrection, and it could get a brand new leader. The winter meeting of the Republican National Committee kicks off today. Party leaders will map out a comeback strategy and elect a party leader. Six candidates are competing for the RNC chairmanship, including incumbent Mike Duncan. A trail of icy misery is stretching across the Southern Plains and Ohio Valley and heading into New England. Hundreds of thousands are without power, and Chuck Wolf from the Kentucky Transportation Cabinet has a miserable warning for commuters in his state.
It's getting more treacherous. The forecast indicates that much of Kentucky is going to be encrusted in a pretty hazardous coating of ice.
Oklahoma and Kentucky governors have declared a state emergency, and at least 19 deaths are blamed on the winter storm that spread a glaze of ice and snow from the southern plains to the east coast. Let's look at some of the stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. And as we've been noting this morning, John Updike died yesterday at the age of 76, and he often worried that people no longer read books, and we want to hear from you. Was Updike right? And you're going to love this one. Jen wrote on our website, John Updike is right. I've been trying to get my nieces to love to read. I take them to bookstores, and they look at the pens. I can barely get them to read magazines. It makes me sad because when you have a book, you are never bored, and they are always claiming, I'm bored. But I will keep trying. Oh, and Adora, she writes, I have been a closet Twilight reader, but now that I know you read them openly, I have been set free. Thanks. Free at last.
We're soulmates. Thank you so much, Jen. I know it's terrible, but, you know, everything can't be so introspective. Sometimes you need brain candy.
Absolutely. And tell us your brain candy. Was Updike right? If you're a reader, what was the last book you read and why? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And if you don't read books, where do you go to express your sense of literacy?
We're going to talk about President Barack Obama. It appears that he's trying to make good on his promise to lead in a bipartisan manner. Yesterday, he was on Capitol Hill meeting with Republicans who are resisting his proposed $825 billion recovery plan. For those who know the president, even those who have very different views than his, say it's no surprise he's reaching out. Bradford Berenson would be one of those people. They were classmates at Harvard Law School and editors for the Harvard Law Review. Good morning and welcome, Bradford.
Good morning to you.
I should also add you worked in the Bush White House and the counsel's office from 2001 to 2003. So you're a Republican, Barack Obama is a Democrat, but yet and still, when you worked together, you had a few kumbaya moments?
Oh, I don't know if there was anything on the Harvard Law Review that really resembled a kumbaya moment, but we did work very productively together, as he did with many of the other conservatives and Republicans on the review at that time.
And you talk about how the president has a gift for negotiating. Explain.
Well, when conflicts would arise on the review, he usually set himself up as almost a mediator. And the pattern that we're seeing now in these early days of his presidency is somewhat surprisingly to me a familiar one. He would typically meet with each side of the dispute separately. Hear them out, let them have an opportunity to say their piece, explain their views. Typically in those meetings, he would indicate agreement in some way or another with some aspect or another of the point of view being expressed by one side and then the other side. He would then work a process to try to get people together to resolve their differences amongst themselves. And when they couldn't, he would obviously then step in and make the decision. Often it was kind of a Solomonic decision that gave each side a little something. But even in the instances where it wasn't, the process that he went through of genuinely listening and trying to understand where everybody was coming from made people feel like they had received a fair hearing, and it made his decisions easier to accept.
You talk about how his consistency has just been staggering. And when you say that, what do you mean?
Well, I would be the first one to say that one shouldn't too quickly draw any analogies between the presidency of the Harvard Law Review and the presidency of the United States. They're obviously extremely different in every imaginable way. And I had a lot of doubt during the election whether the rather pragmatic and moderate Barack Obama that I worked with on the review in the early 90s would be the same man who ran a transition and began to govern as president. But I've been quite surprised by how familiar his conduct and behavior has been in that regard, and how much, so far at least, he really does seem to be genuinely at his core, despite an overall liberal philosophy, interested in working with the other side across the aisle and trying to achieve compromise and consensus in a practical way.
And you talk about how he's not one for petty small things. Tell us about that bagel incident when you guys were in law school.
Yeah, well, he was a few years older than the rest of us because of the experiences he'd had in Chicago before coming to law school. And so a little bit more mature. And back, you know, when in your early 20s, a few years can make a real difference. And he often reacted with some amusement to the heat and passion that the other editors brought to debates over really silly things, one of which was whether we ought to have fresh bagels available in Gannett House early in the morning. The editors would come in, they'd typically grab a bagel and go to class, and some people thought that when law review editors walked into a large lecture with a nice bagel, it seemed elitist, and so there was a big debate. over that.
Well, he's got his priorities straight. Barack Obama certainly does. I guess what I'm wondering, Bradford, is if this is more than just a tactical, stylistic sense on the part of Barack Obama, if there may be some sort of philosophical underpinning that delivers the impulse to go immediately to the person you most disagree with, the person who's least like you. For instance, the interview with Al Arabiya as an opening gesture. Is this come from some sort of philosophical orientation?
I don't know whether there's a philosophy that underpins it or whether it's mere tactics and sort of a smart way to co-opt or at least mute a lot of your opposition. But really the proof is going to be in the pudding, because certainly in Washington and on Capitol Hill, if you merely go through the motions of listening, but then the substance of what you do doesn't actually reflect an accommodation of the other side's priorities, you won't get away with this for very long. People will see it for what it is. So the real test is going to be whether the Republicans that he talks to on the Hill not only feel like he listens to and understands their concerns, but whether in some way or another he's willing to trim his policy sails to accommodate those concerns. And so far there are decent signs of that, in the sense that he has insisted that the stimulus package include a significant tax cut component for lower-income Americans, which has been a priority for the Republicans as opposed to simply additional spending.
Well, it's going to be interesting days ahead for your former classmate, huh?
I think all of them will be, yes.
Bradford Berenson, we appreciate you joining us this morning.
It's my pleasure.
Bradford appeared in the PBS Frontline documentaries The Choice and Dreams of Obama. Both were produced by our partners at WGBH Boston. You can watch them online at pbs.org.
As we've noted in the program all morning, John Updike is dead at age 76. He often worried, as a prolific writer, that people would no longer read books in the future. So we want to hear from you. Is Updike right?
This is Ernesto Gaglione. I am reading, actually, currently, The Things That Rich People Know and Desperately Want to Keep Secret, and I just finished The 4-Hour Work Week by Timothy Ferris. I typically read books that will help me grow my business and prosper.
Well, tell us the last book you read and why. And if you don't read books, what do you read? Blogs, columns? Do you listen to podcasts instead? Elizabeth Wheeler has this one, which is interesting. I always read several books at a time, she writes. Right now, it's Doris Kearns Goodwin's Team of Rivals, an Obama favorite. Gail Sheehy's Hillary's Choice. Marion Zimmer Bradley's The Mists of Avalon. There's a classic. And a small book named Fairy about the early 20th century on Staten Island, my home. Reading is not dead, she says. Team of Rivals is on my Kindle. That's the digital book you can get on Amazon. The rest are paper. Paper, I've heard of that.
Yeah, I kind of do.
Keep up the good work. I wouldn't miss your show, she says. Well, we don't have to read that. She loves the personalities and the great brains, of course. That's the takeaway. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
Last year, the tone had actually already shifted. And most people here, to the extent they saved themselves, they sold their stock.
Last year, members or people at the Davos World Economic Forum sold their stock. What'll they do this year? Andrew Ross Sorkin is reporting on the gathering. He's chief mergers and acquisitions reporter for the New York Times. We're always on. If you missed anything, you can take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. Maybe we can get on Kindle.
Kindle would be good. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
El Paso, a suburb of chaos where violence is an easy commute.
El Paso and Juarez are one unit. What happens across the border eventually will have repercussions on the American side.
One El Paso, Texas businessman says murder is becoming a daily commute from the Mexican side of the border in Juarez. 2 million people, one border, one huge story. Mexican instability. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, January 28th. And, John, we're going to have a report coming up on exactly what's happening down at the Mexico-U.S. border.
Serious situation, that's for sure. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning to you, John, and good morning to everyone. Coming up, we'll also have the Blagojevich tapes. You'll hear the words that have gotten him in trouble, or at least some of them. And we're also going to be taking a look at what's happening with the Republican Party. There's an overhaul this week. Those stories coming up, more. But first, the top stories of the hour.
U.S. Special Envoy George Mitchell is now in what could be the most critical phase of his Mideast peace mission. He meets with Israelis and Palestinians, and he promises he's there to do actual business.
The United States is committed to vigorously pursuing lasting peace and stability in the region. The decision by President Obama to dispatch me to come to this region less than 1 week after his inauguration is a clear and tangible evidence of this commitment.
He will attempt to get something tangible from Israel's prime minister and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. They're allied with Fatah in the West Bank, Abbas is. Mitchell has no plans to meet with the other party in the conflict, Hamas, based in Gaza. As if to remind Mitchell how tough the job is, new Gaza violence has flared up today. Israeli warplanes bombed tunnels into Gaza that it says weapons smugglers use. And yesterday, a roadside bomb killed an Israeli soldier.
The economy is topic A in Washington. The House votes on the economic stimulus plan. President Obama is personally making the case for Republican support.
I don't expect 100% agreement from my Republican colleagues, but I do hope that we can all put politics aside and do the American people's business right now.
He made a personal visit to Capitol Hill Republicans yesterday, but it appears today's House vote will lack major Republican support, sure to disappoint the president. Today, the president will be at the Pentagon to meet with top commanders. President Obama wants more troops in Afghanistan and withdrawal from Iraq within 16 months. The generals will give him their take on how that could happen.
It's a big week for the rebuilding Republican Party. The winter meeting of the Republican National Committee kicks off today. Party leaders will debate a comeback strategy. They'll elect a party leader. It's a tough fight for the party chair, and we'll tell you all about who else is in the race later this hour. In about half an hour, the Dow starts trading at 8174. Yesterday, it closed up by almost 1%. The S&P begins at 845. You know, 60,000 layoffs will do that to the stock market. It gained more than 1% yesterday as well. John Updike died yesterday at age 76. He often worried that people no longer read books. What we're interested in, do you think Updike is right? We want to hear from you, and especially if you don't read novels or can't remember the last book you read. What do you read? Do you listen to podcasts instead? Is it online magazine, blogs, Twitter feeds? Call us. Tell us what you last read and what you do read. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Perhaps it's more than a question of style for our new president. Barack Obama, it seems, on his first impulse, has the inclination to go to the people who disagree with him most. And that's what he did yesterday in Washington. He was on Capitol Hill to personally press Republicans to get behind his economic stimulus package.
We had a wonderful exchange of ideas, and I continue to be optimistic about our ability to get this recovery package done to put people back to work. Obviously, the news over the last couple of days, the number of layoffs that are taking place all across the country has just underscored how severe this recession is and how urgent it is that we act. I recognize that we're not going to get 100% of support, but I think everybody there felt good.
Did everyone feel good who was at that meeting? Joining us is Congressman Kevin Brady. He's a Republican representing Texas's 8th District. He joins us from Washington. Congressman Brady, how good did you feel after that meeting yesterday?
Well, the president is very smart and very charming, but we just disagree completely on the fundamentals of the stimulus, not only how the money is spent, but how effective it will be. And at the end of the day, who's going to pay for it, because ultimately someone's going to have to, and it's going to be not just the wealthy, but middle-class families and small businesses.
Congressman Brady, he made a lot of mention of the layoffs that were announced yesterday. You know, tens of thousands of layoffs, you know, each day we're getting these announcements. Does that move you at all to maybe up the urgency here and not vote no?
Well, no, mainly because the stimulus wouldn't address those layoffs, and that's, I guess, what the frustrating thing is. The tax incentives in these are puny. I mean, for an average worker, it's $1.35 a day more in their paycheck. They're not going to rush them all for consumer demand. The incentives for small businesses to invest is smaller than what they're going to spend to buy new art in America, and that's the problem. This stimulus is missing the mark, but it is spending just an unbelievable amount of money.
Well, let's go back on that detail you just threw out there. We're spending less on art than for what?
We're spending about $50 million for the National Endowment of Arts in this bill, but only $41 million to encourage small businesses to buy and expense new computers, equipment, and machines that they need.
Well, but, I mean, there's my frustration. Okay, I mean, those numbers are different. Okay, so in this bill, what the small businesses get is $41 billion, whereas the National Endowment
million.
For the Arts, or million, the National Endowment for the Arts gets $50 million. But you're ignoring the entire Small Business Administration's budget, which dwarfs the National Endowment for the Arts. Isn't this just the same kind of obstructionist rhetoric, setting up arts programs against the middle class that really stalled things for 8 years under President Bush?
No, it really isn't. I'll tell you why. Before coming to Congress, I was a Chamber of Commerce manager for 18 years, worked with small businesses every day, worked with the SBA programs every day. The loan programs and all that they do in their budget are very helpful, but not in a recession. They're not. They don't create jobs. And so, no, it's actually an apples-to-apples comparison. Our argument is, if you're going to help small businesses create jobs, why don't you do a 20% income deduction, help them keep more of their money, real dollars? That would help keep people on their payrolls and help them buy the new equipment that can help keep them competitive. So, no, it's not obstructionist. In fact, one of the things we asked the new president is, look, if you're serious about bipartisanship, and we are, direct Speaker Pelosi and Majority Leader Reid to sit down with some Republicans, because right now this is a one-party bill, and everyone knows it.
Well, I mean, in some respects, that maybe reflects the political realities of where Barack Obama stands right now. But if you were to put something in this bill, what would it be besides a 20% reduction in income tax for small businesses?
You know, if I were going to help in recessions, we've had eight major recessions since 1948. Each of the stimulus packages did the exact same thing, which is arrive far too late to really do much good. This one's going to do the same. I would first, to boost consumer demand, I would lower the 10% and the 15% tax margins and rates. That would allow a family to keep almost $3,200 more of their money. I would do the small business deduction. I wouldn't do any of the frivolous spending, and I'd do a housing tax credit tied to a down payment. And then I'd probably focus on real infrastructure, not the type we have in this bill, which is just a tiny, tiny part of the whole 3% of the whole bill. So, yeah, we have some better ideas. And I would guarantee the American people that we weren't going to raise taxes to pay for this, because in the end, this bill is so big, it would require doubling of all the income taxes in America for 1 year to pay for this. And we think that actually harms our economy in the long run.
Right, but lowering the taxes to the level that you're talking about also increases the deficit. So I'm a little unclear as to how you would reconcile that. Let me just...
I'll tell you what, $150 billion in this bill provide workers $1.35 a day isn't going to stimulate the economy. That we know.
So, in other words, what proof do you have that cutting taxes would be the magic bullet? It all sounds kind of simple, Congressman. You just cut everyone's taxes and all of a sudden it's, you know, the sun comes out.
No, and you're right. But here's what you do. If you look at it, history is a great guide for us. And each time that there is a tax cut that is a longer-term one tied with monetary programs for the recession, it works. But you have to have that monetary expansion. The truth of the matter is, as much as Congress would like to believe we control the economy, in recessions, in the short run, it's the policy the Fed does that has a much greater impact than the fiscal policy that Congress does. So
All right.
If you do long-term from our side and short-term from monetary, it actually does work.
Except that those rules don't apply with the Fed rate already at a record low near zero. The Fed doesn't have many more levers here. And the monetary policy, it seems to me, is off the table because there isn't the global borrowers who are going to finance either the U.S. deficit or help to keep interest rates low so that there will be lending. The financial system is really broken down. Here, whatever cash comes out of Congress seems to be it here. There's not anything else globally that's going to help out.
Actually not. You make two good points. One is that the global market isn't buying debt. They are buying American debt. And with this stimulus, America is going to go out to the world for $3 trillion in treasury notes in 1 year. It's never happened. It's never happened, period. And a lot of people are nervous that the world isn't going to buy this debt. And the second point is that monetary policy right now isn't working because there is no confidence. There's no confidence in Wall Street, no confidence in the bailout. There's no confidence in Congress, which has record low approval ratings. And until we force to the surface the bad loans that are out there already on the books, the second wave of mortgage problems we all know are coming, until we force those problems to the surface and address them, which is separate from monetary, separate
right.
from fiscal, you're right. We won't get ourselves out of there. But
although, Congressman,
really
I don't know how
a plan for that.
Right, I don't know how much forcing is going to be required. That stuff seems to be every month coming to the surface, and we're getting more and more bad news. Let me just say on the confidence question, and it's really a profound point that you make, but I just wonder if conservatives are serious about confidence and developing confidence in the U.S. economy when people like Rush Limbaugh say on the air, I hope he fails. How does that help to increase confidence globally in the U.S. economy?
Well, the conservatives in Congress don't hope the president fails. In fact, we told them that yesterday. We very much want him to succeed. We may not have backed him in this election, but he is our president. We're not only praying for him, but we'd like to help him in any way. And we respectfully just have a different view of how we dig our way out of this economy. And we'd like to work together. There's no question about it.
All right. Well, Congressman, so you don't want the president to fail. Does that mean there's some common ground here that you would actually agree with Barack Obama,
yeah.
that listening to Rush Limbaugh is not a way of getting things done in Washington?
well, I know
come on, buddy.
I know you gave me a little grief for comparing art to small business, so don't try to wrap me into Rush's comments. Our point is, look, we just have a fundamental difference in how you get ourselves out of this. And I tell you what, we had a really good meeting with the president yesterday.
All right. Well, he didn't rise to the top of the Chamber of Commerce there in Texas 8th District for nothing. Congressman Kevin Brady, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Congressman Kevin Brady is expected to vote no on the stimulus package, which does come up for a vote in the House today. $825 billion bipartisanship in the House, probably not going to be there. Better luck in the Senate.
Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Updike is dead at age 76, but one thing he worried about a lot during his long life as a writer was that people no longer read books, that reading is declining. Was Updike onto something there?
Hi, my name is Nancy Erdman. I'm calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. I think the novels of Sue Miller, including the latest one, The Senator's Wife, are among my favorites. I'm a person way over 40 who reads constantly, and I hope that there are others out there. I'm sure the younger people will come along in some way or other. My own kids don't read too much.
Yeah, we want some younger people to come along here. If you read, tell us what it is that you read. You can text us. You can log on to mytakeatatakeaway.org or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. If you don't read books, what do you read? The Watchmen movie is coming out. One of the first graphic novels, The Watchmen, came out in the 1980s. Did you read that? Call us and tell us. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatatakeaway.org.
Is it a good one?
Oh, it's great. It's an incredible comic book graphic novel experience. I'm so excited about the movie, and the book was fantastic. There's no way the movie can reach the book.
There is a lot of excitement in Illinois yesterday.
It's another Blagoy Day.
Yes, the impeachment trial of Rod Blagojevich continues today, but yesterday there was much anticipation as lawmakers waited to hear portions of the much-talked-about secret FBI recordings of the governor. Only a little bit of those recordings was played. Amanda Vinicky of Illinois Public Radio was there, and she joins us now. Good morning, Amanda.
Good morning, and you're correct. It was only 4 phone calls, and in total it lasted only about 5 minutes. So there had been, as you said, a lot of anticipation to hear these, but those who wanted to hear more only got their appetites wet just a bit.
Set the scene for us. The trial has begun. Give us the few moments leading up to when the tapes are played.
Well, this was the second day of the trial that the playing of these tapes occurred, and most of the morning had been spent going through the criminal complaint that came out on December 9th when Governor Blagojevich was first arrested. And the FBI agent that had been primarily involved with that investigation was on the stand, and he didn't really say very much. In fact, when going through and being questioned by the senators, there was someone else from the U.S. Attorney's Office that would say, yes, you can answer, or no, you can't answer. And oftentimes the answer was no, because he was very restricted to what he could talk about. And basically, he just said, yes, this is fair and accurate. Everything that's contained in the criminal complaint is right. And they moved on from that point.
We have a 20-second bit of sound, as you've noted, not much. But this is a conversation between the governor and his former chief of staff, Lon Monk. What can you tell us about it?
These tapes all involve a piece of legislation that prosecutors say proves Blagojevich was engaged in a quid pro quo or pay to play, basically asking for a campaign contribution in order to sign this legislation. So the whole set of phone calls, this is the fourth of the four that we're going to hear coming up, and it involves Blagojevich and his chief of staff and his brother's on a tape talking about this earlier as well, trying to get a horse racing track owner to pony up some campaign cash is what prosecutors say this is all oriented towards. And so that's what you hear here. I think it's going to start with Lon Monk asking Blagojevich to call this horse racing track owner, kind of put some pressure on.
Let's hear it.
It's better if you do it just from a pressure point of view.
Yeah, good. I'll call him and say, yeah, we want to do an event downstate. I thought we want to do it, and we hope to do this. We can get together and start picking some dates to do a set bill sign. Right?
Okay, so what are the chances, based on my conversation with you yesterday, that this gets done next week?
You know, they're good.
That doesn't sound exactly like a smoking gun, not any talk about selling a Senate seat or anything like that.
Right. And we knew that there would be nothing regarding a U.S. Senate seat. I mean, the prosecutors have hours upon hours of wiretapped tapes and phone conversations from the governor's campaign office, the governor's home, Lon Monk's cell phone, other individuals' cell phones, videotapes even. This is only a very, very small portion. And they released it, they say, just because it's involving this particular piece of legislation that was cited in the criminal complaint. And even getting to this point took quite some time in terms of court dates, and Blagojevich and his attorneys had protested on their release. So, no, I don't think that it's as salacious as everyone had expected. There'd been a lot of talk about the profanity-laden tapes and described in the criminal complaint. We don't hear any of that. The governor
again,
didn't swear
yes,
once.
And we have a second clip, actually, and this is the governor and Lon Monk, his former chief of staff, talking.
I feel like there's somebody else who's holding him back.
No.
I believe it's Chris.
No.
No. Well, what's, a whole year. You know what I mean?
Amanda, what were they talking about there?
It's continuing to talk about this legislation. He's saying, you know, it's taken a whole year to get this campaign contribution, or at least that's what prosecutors want us to believe. Blagojevich has maintained this is all taken out of context. However, he obviously has not been present at the trial. Instead, he's kind of going on this media blitz in New York, actually. So he hasn't been in Springfield, nor have any of his attorneys, to protest this. But prosecutors say that's continuing. And you see on those tapes, Blagojevich, Karen, and wanting this campaign contribution, saying, why is it taking a whole year? We got to put this pressure on. I want that money.
What was the reaction from the lawmakers who heard the tapes? I would hazard to guess they weren't bowled over by it.
No, you did have some senators saying, you know, just to hear the governor's voice. And they know, I think, enough of the background, whereas the public might not hear this and say, wow, that's some ripe audio. Senators that know, some of them were very struck by it. Others, however, say, you know, this is not at all what I'd been expecting. This is politics, and you wheel and deal in politics all the time. This is business as usual, and I didn't hear anything.
Well, that might be good news for Rod Blagojevich. Amanda Vinicky, thank you.
Thank you.
Amanda Vinicky is a State House reporter for Illinois Public Radio. That's WUIS. And now we turn to Femi Oke, who's got some headlines for us.
Thank you very much. The time is 29 minutes past the hour. George Mitchell is in Israel today, and he said that the President Obama was sending a clear signal to the Middle East that helping to secure a peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians was a priority of his administration. The truce is only 10 days old and is in a fragile condition at the moment. President Obama will visit the Pentagon today for a meeting on Iraq. He will talk with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The president spoke with his top generals in Iraq last week, and he says he wants to hear options before devoting himself to his 16-month timeline for the removal of troops. Unemployment rose in every state last month. That's according to a new report from the Labor Department. Indiana and South Carolina had the largest increases. Michigan and Rhode Island were hit hard too. And on the low end, Wyoming and both the Dakotas came in with rates around about 4%.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adore Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Markets open on Wall Street, and the Dow and S&P are strongly opening. We'll see what happens in the early going. John Updike died yesterday at age 76. He often worried that people no longer read books. Was Updike right?
I love to read. I read constantly. What I'm not as interested in reading are lyrical tales of elderly men living in Connecticut and having affairs with wise, young, 20-something women. Have a great day.
Many have said that before. Tell us from your own lives. Was Updike right? Are there fewer readers? What was the last book you read and why? And if you don't read books, tell us what you do read at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org. So for Mike Duncan, the head of the Republican National Committee, you might say today is the first day of the rest of his life.
Thank you for taking a few minutes out of your busy schedule and allowing me to speak with you about the Republican Party. I'm seeking re-election as chairman of the Republican National Committee and wanted to reflect for a few moments on where we are today and share with you my vision of what tomorrow holds for our grand old party.
Well, thank you, Mike. Mike Duncan, of course, the head of the RNC at the Republican National Committee's winter meetings, which begin today. By the end of the week, the RNC will have elected a new chairman. The race for the chairmanship has just started to really heat up. There's no shortage of contenders for the job, including Mike Duncan, who was speaking just there, to break down who might take the lead for the GOP and what it means for the vision and direction of the party is Politico reporter Alex Burns, who joins us from Washington. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So what's at stake here? I mean, on the one sense, this is sort of really inside baseball. I mean, does anybody really think that a new RNC chief, you know, is going to herald some grand new vision for the GOP? Or is this about sort of fighting over the spoils of what's left from a very, very bad outcome in 08?
Well, you know, I think it's a little bit of both there. I think that this election has probably taken on sort of outsized importance in the eyes of a lot of Republicans because it is their first chance to really sort of choose a direction for themselves after that really devastating loss in November. You know, do they want to stick with a chair like Mike Duncan, who is known as a sort of low-profile operations guy, excellent at fundraising, but I think like you heard in that clip you just played, not necessarily a really dynamic and magnetic media personality? Or do you want to maybe go in a new direction with someone like Michael Steele, the former lieutenant governor of Maryland, someone with less organizational experience, but someone who would certainly put a different kind of face on the Republican Party? He is one of the party's few African Americans. And someone who's very comfortable on the airwaves.
And he's not the only African-American contender for this position. Talk about Ken Blackwell. Would he be another magnetic character, you know, very much in contrast to Mike Duncan?
I think he would be in some respects. I think something that Ken Blackwell would do for Republicans that Mike Duncan and Michael Steele don't do, and that really maybe none of the other contenders do. Now, Ken Blackwell is a very strident, hard-right conservative in this race, and I think that electing him would really show that the people who are still sort of holding the reins of power in the Republican Party are the very conservative members who have driven it for the last 8 or so years.
He also comes from sort of economic ground zero, Ohio Secretary of State, former Ohio Secretary of State. I mean, he's right in the middle of where Republicans need to gain votes.
That's exactly right. That said, you know, Republicans who are maybe a little resistant to the idea of electing Ken Blackwell point out that he was not so successful at getting votes in Ohio. In his last run there, when he ran for governor in 2006, he lost by 20-some points. But, of course, that was a bad year for Republicans all across the country.
Alex, given all the people on the list, who do you think is best in a position to really overhaul the Republican Party? We've heard so many people say that what needs to happen. They need to take a look at who they are and what they stand for.
Well, certainly each of the candidates running against Duncan have something to offer in terms of reform. We talked about Steele. We talked about Blackwell. There are also two state party chairs. Kate and Dawson, who runs the South Carolina Republican Party, and Saul Anuzis, who runs the party in Michigan. They're both sort of very well-known state leaders who have been fairly successful, Dawson more than Anuzis, at winning races in their home states. They're people who could bring to the chairmanship a certain savoir-faire when it comes to actually dealing with Republican activists out in the field. All that said, when you talk about who's actually best capable of reforming the Republican Party, there's a sort of counterintuitive case you could make that it's Mike Duncan, that this is someone who knows all the people on the inside, and so maybe he's the one who can take the message to them and say, you gotta really perk up here. And
yeah, that would be counterintuitive.
Although that's part of the way the GOP operates. I mean, it's not as though there are big, powerful people moving behind the scenes here. This has to be a consensus that comes from all of the sort of party officials all around the country. It's a very frustrating process, it seems to me.
I think that's right. And, you know, when you look at RNC chairs from the past, folks who have taken over the party and really brought a message of reform, Republicans always talk about Haley Barbour, who took over the committee in 93 when the party was in a similar kind of position that it's in now, just lost the White House, both houses of Congress. And, you know, Barbour was a real Republican insider. He was a Washington lobbyist and political consultant. But because he knew everybody on the committee, he was able to go to them and say, we've got to start doing things differently. You know, Mike Duncan's not the only person in this race who knows everyone on the committee. Certainly Dawson and Anuzis know people very well. And even Steele and Blackwell have gotten to know the committee much better over the course of this campaign. But whoever, if the eventual winner does want to change the party and the way it does business, they are going to need to do that on the strength of their personal relationship.
Any chance, Alex, in just a couple seconds before we go, there's a sort of Sarah Palin, nobody ever expected it kind of blow away choice that might come out of this meeting?
I don't think so. In order to be nominated, you need a certain amount of support from a certain number of states, so you really can't sort of dive in at the moment, although there are a lot of Republicans who hope that someone else will emerge.
So probably no surprises, but conceivably a new direction from the GOP winter meetings. Alex Burns, political reporter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Alex Burns joined us from the Monitor Studios down in Washington, D.C., where those meetings are starting today. Femi Okeh has the headlines.
Hello there. The time is 22 minutes to the top of the hour. Investors may be excited about new moves from the Federal Reserve to revive the economy. The group announces new policy decisions this afternoon. Analysts say the Fed could expand a program that ups the availability of consumer loans. It's also expected to keep its key interest rate at its record low between 0.25%. President Obama's expansive stimulus package looks likely to pass when it's put to a vote in the House today. The Democrats have enough votes to pass the bill without help from the GOP, but that didn't keep the president from urging the Republicans to vote for it. He wants the bill to have bipartisan support. Eric Holder is likely to be confirmed as the country's first African-American attorney general today. The Judiciary Committee will vote before the full Senate, and it helps that the committee's top Republican, Arlen Specter, says he'll back him.
Mr. Holder was candid in conceding with respect to the rich pardon that he made a mistake.
Holder had received criticism from several Republicans for his role in pardons granted by the former president, Bill Clinton. Our partners at the New York Times are reporting on a murder-suicide in Los Angeles. Irvin Lupo shot his wife and five young children before killing himself yesterday. And police say that Lupo and his wife had been fired from their jobs and they decided death was their way of escape. And they faxed their local TV station shortly before the family of seven were discovered dead.
Oh, that is a crazy story.
An interesting addendum to that story is that the mayor of Los Angeles is asking residents experiencing financial stress to talk to their friends and their neighbors, get some counseling to get back on their feet and keep their families afloat.
A good point. Not knowing your neighbors is a bad situation in this environment.
Very true.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. The Super Bowl will be played in Tampa on Sunday, as many of you know, and a group of Boston University researchers has gathered there in advance of the game. They're announcing findings of an investigation into brain injury in one former NFL player that is part of a still controversial body of evidence that may link professional football to brain damage. Dr. Robert Stern, an associate professor of neurology at Boston University, has joined us to explain his report. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
So what are your most significant findings?
Well, I guess the most significant finding is that we have now found the sixth out of six retired NFL players who died prematurely, whose brains were studied for this disease called chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And we found chronic traumatic encephalopathy in this six out of six player, which means all of the players who have been studied over the age of 35, between 35 and 50, have shown evidence, significant evidence, of this degenerative disease that eventually would cause dementia in these individuals.
Couldn't it be linked to other factors?
Well, this disease is a very specific, unique disease that's diagnosed only under a microscope after the person passes away. And it is has a unique footprint in the brain that shows that it is indeed chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And as the name of the disease infers, it is caused by repetitive trauma. That's not really controversial. This has been known since the 1920s with boxers who had dementia pugilistica, an older term. And it's the exact same thing. It's a progressive degenerative disease of the brain that's caused by repetitive blows to the head.
So it's just by the mere nature of the game, as opposed to anything that could be done to help protect players better, perhaps?
Well, we don't know that yet. We don't know what puts people at greater risk for getting it. You know, not everyone who plays football is going to get this brain disease. We know that. We hope that there are ways that we can truly prevent this, because it's really only the only preventable cause of dementia that we know of.
And do you know what has the NFL done to investigate this link?
Well, the NFL for a while has had something called a mild traumatic brain injury committee that initially was doing some very nice work on return to play by trying to figure out whether football players, if they had a concussion during a game, should return to play that game or wait out, and they developed ways of doing neuropsychological testing before the season to be able to see how impaired someone might be on the field or after they play.
They've taken a lot of criticism, though, actually, haven't they, for not setting out a better system?
Well, what they've taken criticism for is not taking the actual relationship seriously between repetitive head trauma and a later disease. They, I think, understand that they can do things about concussion, but they haven't taken it seriously enough to say we've got to prevent people from getting ill later in life. I think one of the things that's problematic is that they're feeling that it's the NFL that might cause this disease, and therefore they need to protect themselves by saying it doesn't exist.
So this obviously is going to help further that discussion. Dr. Robert Stern, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Robert Stern is Associate Professor of Neurology at Boston University.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Femi Oke has some headlines for us.
And the time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. Gaza is heating up with new violence today. Israeli warplanes bombed tunnels into Gaza. Israel says that Hamas uses them to smuggle weapons, and the strikes are retaliation for a roadside bombing that killed an Israeli soldier yesterday. No militant group has claimed responsibility for the blast. U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East, George Mitchell, will meet with Palestinians and Israelis. He started his mission in Egypt, where he clarified what he wanted to do in the Middle East.
The United States is committed to vigorously pursuing lasting peace and stability in the region. The decision by President Obama to dispatch me to come to this region less than 1 week after his inauguration is a clear and tangible evidence of this commitment.
George Mitchell will meet with Israel's Prime Minister and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, and Abbas is allied with Fatah in the West Bank. Mitchell has no plans to meet with the Gaza-based Hamas leaders, and he said just this morning that a Gaza truce must be based on an end to smuggling and the opening up of borders. President Obama will be at the Pentagon talking with top generals today. The main topics will be Iraq and Afghanistan, getting out of one and going big in the other. The president wants an Iraq troop withdrawal within 16 months. And there's some more bad news for Toyota, and in this case, it may affect the car sitting in your driveway. It is recalling 1.4 million cars around the world. The 830,000 Yaris hatchbacks and sedans are included in the recall, and that model is sold in America, and this follows another recall just last week. And last year, the company posted the first operating loss in its history. Let's look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
That's the Yaris,
hatchback? That's right.
Well, thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So John Updike died yesterday at age 76. He often worried that people no longer read books, and so we're asking you, was Updike right? Michael Doyle writes us an email to say, I'm a 28-year-old living in Montreal. I have read before going to sleep every night since I was a very small child. I always read one piece of nonfiction and one of fiction at the same time. Right now, it's Forever War by Dexter Filkins.
I'm reading
great
that,
book.
Too. I'm
and
reading
the
that, too.
Complete Fictions of Borges, which has led me to attempt a short story of my own. We still read Mr. Updike. Or we still read, Mr. Updike. You can rest, Michael Doyle says. That's great. I listen to your show on my iPhone at work every day. Thanks for existing. Well, we're happy to exist, too. From your own lives, was Updike right? What do you read? Was it a book or something else? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Joining us now on quite a different matter is Diana Washington Valdez. Diana, is it safe to say that you actually live in a war zone?
Absolutely.
She's a reporter for the El Paso Times. She wrote for the Pulitzer Prize-nominated El Paso Times series, Death Stalks the Border. She's also the author of the forthcoming book, Mexican Roulette, Last Cartel Standing. And one of the big stories that you cover day in and day out in El Paso is the uneasy relationship between the city of El Paso and the Mexican city of Juarez and the instability from Mexico in relationship to the drug war. And it's apparent moving across the border into El Paso. Why would instability in Mexico target Americans in El Paso?
Because we have a lot of white-collar workers who frequently travel to Juarez, have been the targets of kidnappings, of carjackings. Some people have been kidnapped for ransom and have had to pay out hundreds of thousands of dollars. We have U.S. corporations operating in Ciudad Juarez in the assembly plants, up to maybe 280 at this point, biggest employer in Ciudad Juarez. And all of these companies, some of them are threatening to leave because of the insecurity. We've had at least half a dozen kidnappings in El Paso that ICE has documented since this crackdown on the so-called drug cartels began a year ago.
And ICE is the Customs and Enforcement Immigration Department, part of Homeland Security.
Customs Enforcement Agency, yes.
Right, part of Homeland Security. Well, just to give a sense of how, you know, part of the, you know, day-to-day life in El Paso this is, here's some words from Beto O'Rourke, who's a member of the El Paso City Council, talking about what happens in Juarez not being far removed from the people of El Paso at all. Listen to this.
You talk to so many people who have had relatives killed or affected in Juarez in one way or another. Their businesses were extorted. Someone was kidnapped. Someone witnessed a shooting or saw a beheaded body dumped in the street. And so on a very personal level, it affects so many of us and so many families in the El Paso Ciudad Juarez region, because we're literally physically joined at the hip. We're one giant metroplex of over 2 million people.
Diana, it sounds like he's describing Baghdad, but that's your town.
That's right. It sounds incredible, but part of it is also because we received very little attention from the media. This is absolutely something that has spun way out of control. The violence is brutal. It is daily. We've already, like, to more than 130 murders so far this month in Ciudad Juarez, and there's no end to it.
And last year it was something like 1,500 or more? Is that true?
1,609, a record number of murders in Ciudad Juarez of men and women.
Wow. Let's talk about the dynamics, at least as far as we can understand them, of how the drug cartels are driving this. The Mexican government launched an initiative really within the last 18 months to crack down on drug cartels. The U.S. has supported that with materiel and with funds. How has that contributed to the instability you're seeing in your border area?
The cartels have had to regroup, and what's has been caused by this crackdown is an internal war among the drug trade lords of Mexico. They're all fighting for the territories, and Juarez, El Paso is one of the most important corridors for cocaine trafficking, cocaine that comes in through Colombia, comes across this border. And then we have the arms trafficking, the arms that are purchased in the United States and taken across the border to Mexico are being used to kill people.
So the availability of guns in the U.S. is actually an enabler of the violence across your border.
Yes, and it's one of the problems that the Mexican government has complained about and that U.S. officials have committed to working more closely to control.
You know, some U.S. generals and military officials have described in the waning days of the Bush administration and as the Obama administration begins that Mexico is on the edge of an abyss. They call Mexico teetering towards becoming a narco state, generating millions of refugees crossing the U.S. border. Do you see it that way, Diana?
Yes, Mexico is already a narco state. All of its institutions have been infiltrated by the drug cartels, high-level government officials, and all the agencies. what is could be the next step. And I think what the military is describing is the possibility that the state itself will fail, will fall to these organized crime lords. And that is very worrisome.
So, Diana, give me a sense. I mean, you're on the streets of El Paso and Juarez talking about this and seeing this unfold in your community. What sort of individual person, individual sort of human story can you tell us briefly that really characterizes how life has changed for the people of El Paso?
Yes, I know a man named Javier Alvarez who has obtained a job as a waiter in El Paso. He fled Ciudad Juarez with his family. He was just an ordinary individual, had a little business in Ciudad Juarez. He saw several of his friends killed, and relatives who had businesses had to shut them down because they were being extorted, asked to pay $20,000 a week, money they didn't know where they were going to get from. So he came over here, and he's struggling to make it. And he says, I don't know what's happened to my country, but there's no way I'm going back. We have to save our lives.
And traditionally, Mexicans who came into the United States were escaping poverty, not a fear for their actual lives. So that's an amazing transformation. Diana, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Diana Washington Valdez is a reporter for the El Paso Times. She wrote for the Pulitzer Prize-nominated El Paso Times series, Death Stalks the Border, about Mexican instability spilling over into El Paso, Texas. Very interesting story. So we're also noting that John Updike died yesterday at age 76, and he often worried that people no longer read books. And we're hearing from you. Was Updike right? Thomas writes an email to say, I don't read at all. I haven't read anything in perhaps 10 years. I do get culture, however. I watch Masterpiece Theater on PBS, and that makes me want to read, but I wind up watching Lost and Grey's Anatomy. Ironically, when I did read, it was Updike. He's a fantastic writer, and it was never a struggle to understand what he was saying. Here's another response.
Hi, this is Mike in Massachusetts. John Updike is my favorite author, and the Rabbit series really changed my life in high school, and I do believe that literary fiction is gone. On a side note, I found John Updike's house one time in Beverly Farms and knocked on the door, and he answered. I shook his hand and left. I've never forgotten that experience.
Beyond wow. Fan. That's a real groupie. This is a great little email. My schoolroom was awash in books, writes Les. My home is awash in books from the library. I've used bookstore and occasionally a new book I'll buy. My gift of choice are all books. What do you say? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.